This podcast is presented by Celery.com, the one-stop shop e-commerce logistics provider.
Welcome to Celery Talks. I'm your host, Tad Kelsey. And this week, it's a pleasure to captain this ship with Dan McElroy.
Hey, Tad. It's awesome to be on board co-hosting with you. I'm really excited for this week's show as a longtime fan of Shark Tank. Let's go behind the scenes and see how it all goes down for companies in the tank. Drop that hook.
ABC's Shark Tank has reached icon status in American television. The show has ridden the wave of the rising entrepreneurial movement in the U.S. It has certainly been the tipping point for many companies and is a substantial economic influencer. This week on Celery Talks, we will speak with one of the Shark's movers and shakers, Abe Minkara.
Abe is the business development director for the Mark Cuban companies. He takes these new partners, most of which are early stage startups, and with his team, helps turn them into lucrative investments. He and his team are e-commerce experts that often develop their Shark Tank investments from scratch. If you've heard a Cuban-partnered Shark Tank company on one of our episodes, it's likely that his team of logistics and marketing gurus have grown the startup's e-commerce channel to an upwards of 30% of their business post-deal.
In our conversation, he took us behind the scenes of what it's like from taping to post-Shark Tank episode airing and how they help grow their Shark Tank companies. Abe, thanks for joining us today. For those listeners who aren't familiar with the Mark Cuban companies, what exactly do you do?
So I'm Director of Business Development at Mark Cuban Companies, and I'm part of a team that supports Mark's portfolio of investments. A lot of our time has been focused on Shark Tank companies. They're very early stage and they need a lot of support. And a lot of those companies are consumer products, which are the type of companies that really do well on Shark Tank because of the type of show and the fact that you can drive people through a website and you can have sales on the site.
To go back in the timeline and just an origin point for you, Abe, where are you from? Where did you grow up?
So I grew up between Middle East, Europe, and the U.S. What brought me to Dallas, where I live now and work with Mark, was an opportunity in the technology sector. I have a background of computer engineering, and then I got my MBA at SMU in Dallas. And then there was an opportunity 5 years ago when Mark was going through his first year of Shark Tank and buying a lot of consumer products, because prior to Shark Tank, Mark was heavy in technology, and he still is in terms of investments. But there were no consumer products in his portfolio prior to Shark Tank, and those early stage consumer product companies needed a lot more support. So he needed to build a team to provide that high level of support to help those companies to kind of accelerate growth and also to be more competitive with the other sharks, which is Mark's nature, because, you know, all the other sharks have a little bit more experience at the time. Now Mark is even more experienced than they are. Like Glory has access to QVC, Damon has access to a lot of retail. So Mark wanted to be more competitive in those spaces and provide more value to the companies that he invests in.
What did life in the Middle East and in Europe and just your journey to the U.S. contribute to who you are today?
The ability to see things from different perspectives. So there's more than one way of looking at a problem. And so there's always different solutions to the same problem. It's simplified to just a matter of perspective. I'm looking at things through different angles. And there's always a solution when you look at things from a different perspective.
Who was your greatest influence, whether it be growing up or in your younger life? Not to say you're really old right now, but...
You know, growing up in Europe, I think Richard Branson was someone I looked up to. Just for everything pretty much that he stands for, in many ways, as just an ambassador for entrepreneurship, as an individual, not just in business, but just as a human being. I think one of the things that interests me in Mark is they have a lot of similar features. And it was great to see Richard Branson become a guest shark in season 9 of Shark Tank. And it was also great to see that, you know, two of my mentors, they fought on the show. I don't know if you remember, but Richard Branson took a glass of water and threw it in Mark's face. And I don't think Mark was very happy about that, but...
It was that genuine?
Yeah. Was that part of the script?
It was genuine. That was not
scripted
at all. Yeah.
So we're really getting behind the scenes here.
When you were in your early 20s, what did you see yourself doing for a career? What, if anything, changed from now and then?
So I always wanted to be in the entrepreneurial space. I have started a company 10 years ago. It was waterless shave gel. So I've always been in that space, and now I support and mentor and help a lot of entrepreneurs. So that's kind of what was really fascinating to me, and I'm fortunate enough to be in that space.
So outside of your unique perspective, living abroad and then coming over to the United States, that coupled with obviously your entrepreneurial pursuits, what led you to venture capital after being an entrepreneur?
It's the experience actually came about from an opportunity to work with Mark. Before that, I had a very well-rounded background with technology, with experience in manufacturing, business consulting, and also some experience with private equity. But when this opportunity with Mark is really what exposed me to the VC world, and I've been working with Mark for 5 years, but it feels like 10. It's just a deep dive on everything. You learn different industries, and obviously the Shark Tank experience working with a lot of early stage companies is very satisfying, but also you learn a lot from the experience, and every company has its challenges, right? And based on the industry, the type of entrepreneur, the opportunity, based on the product and service, the timing, and the willingness of the entrepreneur to execute, right? It's usually at the end of the day, you can have a great business plan, a great product or service, but if the entrepreneur doesn't have really what it takes to grow that company, you know, there's a limit on what that company can do.
So what's interesting to me about your background is because you're diverse, you've come from multiple angles. There's some folks in the audience that want to become, you know, involved in venture capital. And so maybe some of them tend to think that they need to be very specialized in that. And I think you're dispelling, you know, this broad background can be very valuable due to the perspectives that you bring with you. So what would you say in the first 5 years of working with Mark was the most impactful lessons you learned in that early stages of Mark, you know, building out his investment portfolio through Shark Tank and other areas?
One of the most important lessons is, you know, the way we function in our group, especially on the Shark Tank side, all of the investments that Mark makes are minority interest investments, right? So we don't have controlling interest versus like a private equity where that's all they do, right? They buy a company, control it, and run it the way they like. So we have to advise, and every time we need to advise a company on best practices, the right and wrong sales channels to pursue, organizational structure, accounting practices, everything related to a business, we can't just say, this is how you're going to do it. We have to always show value, right? So every time I talk to an entrepreneur about something they need to do, I have to sell them on the value of doing it. I can't just say, you're going to do it because, you know, Mark's going to get upset if you don't. Sometimes it works, but you really have to sell them on value.
So obviously there's going to be a lot of interest in behind the scenes on Shark Tank and the podcast. So one question we'd ask is, what does the process look like in terms of length of time, commitment, how it works when you film, things of that nature?
In terms of a timeline, the show is filmed in June. So all the sharks go to LA for 1 week and they film from morning to night and they have one pitch after the other. And by the way, they have no idea what they're being pitched. The producers keep all that confidential.
So no cheat sheet.
No cheat sheet. So when the door opens, those entrepreneurs walk in and the sharks see them for the first time. And they make their pitch. And on TV, you see a pitch between 2 to 4 minutes. But in reality, those entrepreneurs are standing there hour to 2 hours getting really beaten up by the sharks. And they're getting grilled. So that is a really tough experience. And what happens is if they make a deal with a shark, you see a handshake deal. Now, when that happens, it is a kind of a commitment, but it's not the end deal, right? When that happens, our team goes in and starts the real due diligence, which can take 3 months or more. And so in terms of a timeline, they film in June. Let's say we close sometime end of August. The show starts airing end of September. So right in time for us to step in after the deal closes and start helping that company prepare for the airing of the show. It's a big event and you have to be prepared for it.
What are the added complexities of an entrepreneur coming to an agreement with a shark and then having to face the prospects of an accelerated process to get to an airing first season? What complexity does that add to this relationship that's been created?
I think it's more of an opportunity that they have to seize versus kind of a complexity. So it is a big event and they have to monetize that event as much as they can. So we work together to make sure they're prepared, right? First thing we do is make sure that they have a website that doesn't crash. When we first started, that was a common event because of the traffic, just the viewership, all going to the website. Website just crashed. And when that happens, that's a lot of money that you're not taking advantage of that's left on the table. So now we make sure they're using the right platform. They have enough inventory possible. If they don't, they have a right back order strategy to communicate with their customers' expectations. They have right pricing and shipping. Sometimes it makes a big difference if you have free shipping versus just standard shipping or offer a special Shark Tank discount. A lot of these things add value, and the more you prepare, the more you can maximize your sales when that event happens. I mean, we've seen companies do between $100,000 to $500,000, some have even hit $1 million within the first 3-4 days of airing on a show, which is a big deal, right? And that's benefit to the investor as well. So us as sharks, when we see a lot of a potential up front, that's also a good indicator of what's yet to come. And based on the agreement we have as an investor, you could either at the end of the year say, hey, we did a lot of money. There's enough money to spread as a distribution. Everybody makes money and we move on. Some cases you want to keep the money in the company to kind of keep the growth factor going. So either way, the more you make money on airing the show, the better off you are. But you have to keep building that momentum even beyond the show. And I think that's where it gets complicated for the entrepreneurs is how do we keep that momentum? How do we keep growing at that level? Because that's a one-time event. Even on the re-airing of the show, you don't get that same level of exposure. So you get, usually if you get a re-air, it's about 20 to 30% of the sales that you would get on an initial airing.
Your entrepreneurs that you're working with, do you put them through kind of an initial process? Because obviously it's going to be a shock to what they're about to go through because it's going to be fairly unique given the opportunity.
Yeah, I think it's about setting expectations, right? So as long as we go through the process, we make sure they're on the right e-commerce platform, they have the right strategy fulfilling their products. So either they're fulfilling their own products, they have the right tools to do it, or they outsource it to a company like Celery, right, that fulfills their product. Because of just the high level of exposure in sales, you need to make sure that you have the ability to deliver within, 48 hours. You never want to commit to overnight delivery when you're on Shark Tank. Always say your product will deliver between 5 to 7 days just to be on a safe side. But you have to be prepared. And then making sure they have internally, they've organized some kind of a triage for not just for sales, but for all incoming emails. Because they're going to get requests from customers, they're going to request from wholesalers, from investors, from press. So you need to be able to organize the incoming emails internally between the team and be able to respond as quick as possible and then capitalize on those opportunities as well.
So it's my understanding that everybody involved only is notified 2 weeks in advance of the airing.
That's right.
The original airing of the episode. That goes for investors, the sharks as well.
We know a little bit more. We have more time to prepare. And however, internally, we keep that a secret. It's a confidential thing between us and the Shark Tank producers. Mm. But it allows us to prep them in some form and manner. But yes, it's true. They do get 2 weeks notice prior to their show airing. So they don't have a lot of time. That's why it's up to us as an investor in the company to prepare them as soon as we close. So it's actually beneficial to close fast. And usually that's on our end, we've done it so many times, it's almost like a checklist. So the delays would come from the entrepreneur not responding in time, not providing the financials or the information that was requested in time. Just the whole process, some entrepreneurs decide to change terms. Well, that's a red flag for us. And those are the deals that don't close because there are deals that don't close. Maybe sometimes in due diligence, we do a background check, a red flag comes out for whatever reason, or maybe there's a lawsuit on the company that wasn't disclosed. So there are lots of reasons that could cause a company not to close during due diligence.
Or a patent. It happens. There's always the question, is there a patent? And of course, it's like, we're working on that and it's pending. And
yeah,
I'm sure that's
exactly. Or they said, we did $1 million in sales last year. And you look at the financials, they only did, 100,000 in sales. That's a big difference, right? So for whatever the reason, there are companies that don't close. And those companies that don't close, depending on the shark and the season, vary between 20 to 50% of the deals that they make. Handshake deals on the show. And some of those actually still air. So you would see the handshake deal on TV, but in reality, the investment never happened. Now the company still benefits from the exposure and the sales. So that's still a good thing for them, but they don't get the continued support and accelerated growth and opportunities and partnerships that each shark can provide for them if they would have made the deal.
In your own preparation and being able to prepare the company for that air date, what would you say the average time is between shooting of the show to air date? And is that consistent?
Like I said, they shoot the show in June. And then they also, just to kind of complete the picture, they also shoot another segment early in September, and they're both for a week. And that completes the whole season, because the season starts end of September and ends in May, mid-May. So they basically, almost all of the ones in June launch early, just because of the process of due diligence. So when you close, you're more likely to air. And I think the producers now are becoming a little more stringent on what companies they air. They want to air more companies that have closed versus ones that are not, because they don't want any of, I think they've been called gold diggers. That's a term one of the sharks coined on the show. It's companies who just get on the show just to get the exposure with no intention of making a deal. So to just kind of discourage that, now they're pushing companies that they're more likely to air you as a company if you close the deal with a shark, and committing to the terms versus changing the terms and having the deal not go through.
But again, the sharks still don't know until they get there what they're going to see. It's been, I guess it gets vetted by producers of the show, and that's kind of what
the producers,
becomes a bit of a process.
The producers do all the vetting, and there are several ways to get on Shark Tank. You can either get on the website, so you Google Shark Tank ABC, and there's an application form, so anyone can go on there. A lot of our companies in our portfolio did it that way. You can, sometimes producers go to different industry-specific trade shows, and they scout companies there. And then they also do like an audition type, very similar to an American Idol, where they go to major cities and say, hey, we have Shark Tank auditions, and people come in and do initial pitch. So those are kind of the main three ways to get on Shark Tank, but it's still a very difficult process. And there's a lot of levels to get to LA. And then when you're in LA, it's also, you still have to sell the sharks and make a deal and then close on the deal. So the odds of making on a Shark Tank are very slim. So the ones that make it are very fortunate.
Abe, how much time do you spend on the Shark Tank companies for Mark as opposed to the rest of his portfolio?
We spend a lot of time on the Shark Tank companies. There's other companies that need a lot of support early on, and there are also opportunities to accelerate their growth more than some of the other technology companies. We also, through our relationships in retail, our relationships in e-commerce, we can facilitate introductions, and we can accelerate growth in that way as well. But most of the time, we focus on direct-to-consumer strategy, which is where we see the most value, especially for early-stage consumer product. So obviously, as we mentioned earlier, it's about optimizing your online strategy, your website, making sure you have presence online. And e-commerce to us is way beyond the website. It's everything else, all the other e-commerce channels. The obvious ones, you know, Amazon, right? So especially when you air on the show, besides having the right presence online, you need to have also presence on Amazon, because you'll be amazed how many people use Amazon as a search engine for consumer products. So Amazon presence is very important. Amazon is not just listing your product. There's a lot that goes behind the scenes, right? You make sure you want your product to be qualified as Prime, which means you have to ship to an FBA warehouse. That's another value Celery provides, is as a fulfillment house, they know how to ship and deal with Amazon FBA warehouses. You need to make sure that there's a certain way of optimizing your listing on Amazon. There's something called enhanced content, where you can add videos, you can add more of the story, especially if you're Shark Tank, tell your story as an entrepreneur. You need to optimize the keywords on your listings, very similar to kind of optimizing listings on Google, right, or in your website. You can take advantage of Amazon ads, which are as powerful as, you know, what we've seen conversion-wise as Facebook ads. So there's a lot that goes behind the scenes in making sure you have an optimized presence on Amazon, in addition to optimized presence on your website. And then it's about defining what else is your e-commerce strategy look like, right? You should have the right presence when it comes to social media sites, the obvious ones. And beyond that, what is your strategy? Do you want to work with other e-commerce retailers, or do you want to work with brick and mortar retailers? And it's very important to define what your strategy looked like. You don't want to just dump your product everywhere. You want to say, okay, this is our strategy online, this is our strategy on Amazon, this is our strategy in brick and mortar retail, right? We want to partner with those key retailers, and we want to limit our exposure to maybe specific wholesalers that meet certain criteria. And if they don't, then we're not going to sell them. So it's very important really to define what your strategy is.
Talking about using Amazon as your basis of sales, or FBA being such a prominent factor, we've talked to other entrepreneurs that have chatted with us on how discounting on Amazon by having third-party wholesalers has been a challenge. What do you recommend to your entrepreneurs when they want to keep that premium price point?
Well, that's comes back to what we said earlier, is defining your strategy per channel, right? So if you want the right presence on Amazon, you want to control that presence. You want to restrict resellers. Now, depending on what stage you are, if you already have a lot of wholesale relationships, it's going to be tough. Your wholesalers, or if you're working with a distributor that resells to wholesalers, you lose control, even if you have specific requirements that you sign with those wholesalers that, okay, you're not allowed to sell on Amazon. And if you do, we have a MAP policy for just minimum advertised price. It's still tough to maintain. And Amazon can help, but they can't be the ultimate gatekeeper. It's up to you. So if you are a company that already has a lot of wholesalers and distributors, the only way you could do it on Amazon is to create a product exclusive to Amazon and control it. And do not sell that specific type of product. A variation of the product could be color, it could be a different version. And then you grow that on Amazon exclusively versus giving it to your wholesalers. So start to kind of defining their channels. So back to the strategy per channel. However, if you're early on and you haven't really sold your product to distributors or wholesalers, that's where you can really have the right presence on Amazon. You can start exclusively there and restrict the resellers early on, because if you do it right, you can really grow your presence on Amazon aggressively and successfully and make a lot of profit, not have the issues of other resellers compete with you on price.
For the companies that you work with specifically, there are some that will not go directly to Amazon. They'll take the bump off of the Shark Tank publicity and maybe sell it through a Shopify or something that's not potentially broadcast on Amazon to get that bump, and then that's potential to have that as a channel later. Or is Amazon kind of the defining marketplace at this stage?
Yeah, you need to have Amazon presence. You're missing out if you're not. If you have other resellers competing with you on Amazon or not, as a brand, you need to have clean presence on Amazon as much as you can. So anything you sell on your website, you need to have some kind of presence as a brand on Amazon as well, even if it's with a different product. But just having one listing by itself automatically adds to your SEO because of Amazon's presence. So it's very important to have some kind of an Amazon presence. And if you can do it right, in some cases, we've seen companies that actually make more money on Amazon than on our website.
So Abe, you know, just recently over the Christmas break, I mean, we've seen the results of how large Amazon looms over all. And then the mix between, you know, brick and mortar and Amazon has obviously skewed more toward Amazon. How do you guide your new companies on a decision of mix, whether they go in a store? Obviously, Amazon looks like it's going to have some element, but how do they get that mix right?
It's all about the type of product and category you're in. So there's some product categories that do really well in brick and mortar, and they also do well online. But there's some categories that have been really affected by just the change and challenges of brick and mortar retail. So it's important for those brands to adapt to the changing times and change their strategy. So I'll give you an example. There's a company called Power Practical. They're a Shark Tank company, and they focus on outdoor products, electronics. They start out with a power pot. If you remember the power pot, it's a pot that had thermoelectric pads on the bottom. So you add water to it, put it on a source of heat, cable comes out of the handle, so you can charge your phone or tablet. That product was expensive to make, so it was expensive to sell, and it didn't sell a lot in the retail space. So that was their first challenge. And then with the shift from brick and mortar to online recently, they've also saw other challenges in selling their complementary products, which were lighting products. So what they did is, I remember we were in a board meeting, this was 2 years ago, and we looked at their projections. This was like November 2015, and by July 2016, based on their brick and mortar sales and their growth in that channel, the company was going to go bankrupt. So they needed to do something. And that was where we came up with, there was an opportunity at the time to do something exclusively with Amazon, and they had nothing to lose. So we said, okay, let's do it. So they just had a Kickstarter campaign that was successful. And we decided, instead of taking that product and pushing it through their existing brick and mortar channels, how about we just go exclusive to Amazon and we optimize our listings, and then we put all our time resources on growing our Amazon presence, because there's lower risks. If you know what you're doing, you sell the product, there's no returns, there's no hidden fees. You know, Amazon's not going to ship you back your inventory if it doesn't sell. All those challenges with the brick and mortar retail. And that's what they did. They had, prior to that, $2,000 a month in sales on Amazon. So January 2016, they did $5,000, quite a good improvement. By March, they're around $60,000 a month. And then in June, they were at 90,000 a month. And then they were fortunate enough to be part of Prime Day. And so Prime Day, July 2015, they did 150,000 just on Prime Day. And then they ended up having their largest month ever, which, you know, was the same month that we thought was going to be the day they closed their doors, ended up being their best month ever in the history of the company. And that kind of redefined their strategy. So now they're a company that innovates. They use Kickstarter to bring products to market and validate them by their success on Kickstarter. They also use other crowdfunding sites like Indiegogo. And then they take those products online and on Amazon, channels they control, and they grow them there. And this company has come back and they're going to be doing $10 million this year. So it's an amazing story.
So Amazon's the big factor in the marketplace right now. What do you think's next? What happens next? Is it Amazon increasing their influence? Is there a disruptor in this space?
Well, Amazon is definitely the dominant e-commerce platform right now. How long are they going to maintain this dominance? We don't know. You know, there's Walmart's trying to do a lot of creative things with their acquisition of Jet, but they're also doing, as Walmart, very innovative things, and they're trying to capture some of the market share from Amazon. There might be another company, might be a contender against Amazon. We don't know. But there's also a lot of other players in the market. As a brand, Amazon is definitely something that you have to consider and define your strategy for. There are other sites that you have to consider. You know, there are flash sale sites. Some really do well. If you want to just offload inventory or introduce a new product, they do really well and help you. There is Etsy if you're doing handmade stuff, right? If it fits that audience, why not have an Etsy presence? You have to know your space online and you have to just have those partnerships. Even if you're selling on all those e-commerce platforms and brick and mortar, doesn't necessarily mean you're selling the same product. If you really want to do it well, you have a variation of your product. So each channel has some kind of an exclusivity and something unique to offer. That's how everybody wins.
So Abe, Amazon could be intimidating. You see, you know, on the internet, these massive fulfillment centers. To someone like me, it really kind of equals higher cost, right? You may not get that personal touch that you really are looking for if you have a boutique brand or something. What are some ways outside of, especially early stage when, you know, your revenue goals are maybe not as large as a late stage company, what are some ways you see that folks can, if they're intimidated by a larger Amazon type entity, that they can start to launch an e-commerce business?
It's a matter of just starting the process. It's not as intimidating as it seems. It's very easy for an entrepreneur to set up an Amazon account. And then adding your listings is pretty straightforward. I mean, there's a lot of YouTube videos that help you out, but it's very straightforward. Their seller platform is easy. You can set up a basic account where you fulfill your products. And Amazon takes 15% as just a rev share, which is not much. If you want to just compare it to your other channels on your website, you make the most, then you have Amazon that takes the 15%. And then if you want to go to more brick and mortar traditional retail, you're looking at 50 to 60% that you're going to have to give up. So Amazon's kind of in between. But ideally, where you want to be on Amazon is to be qualified or listed as Prime, which means you have product at an FBA facility. So that could be a little bit intimidating for an entrepreneur, but it's really not. It's just a matter of just defining your product count per case, making sure you know the dimensions of your shipping boxes and weight. And then the system pretty much fits out your shipping label and you just drop it off to a FedEx UPS. Now, that's why a lot of people like to work with Celery, because Celery understands the whole process as a warehouse fulfillment facility. And not only do they facilitate that for smaller companies, but they also know how to do it at a much larger level. And it does definitely help, because it's a matter, as you grow as an entrepreneur, as a brand, you have limitations in space, right? So if you're shipping from your garage, or from your office, as the business grows, you're going to need more warehouse space. It makes more sense, instead of going out and buying a larger warehouse and employing more people, to partner with a trusted company like Celery to fulfill those requirements for you, so that you as an entrepreneur don't have to worry about shipping and you can focus on selling and growing the company.
So Abe, you described this exclusive product that maybe makes sense on a specific channel if you're an omni-channel. Can you give us an example of one company that maybe did that?
Yeah, a great example would be Nuts & More. So Nuts & More is another Shark Tank company. Nuts & More, they make protein-infused peanut butter, and they have a lot of tasty flavors. So they have presence in GNC, they have presence in Vitamin Shoppe, they have presence in a lot of supplement type mom and pop stores all over the country. So they work through a distributor to push through all of those stores, which means all of their SKUs are on Amazon through resellers, their pricing's all over the place. So they wanted to have an Amazon strategy, but because they started out heavy on distribution in brick and mortar early on, it was too late to clean up the space. It will take forever. So what they did is they are very good at launching new products, new flavors. Last year, they had a new flavor that came out and they decided, well, what if we just take this flavor and put it exclusively on Amazon for a limited amount of time? One of their concerns was, what about some of our partners in brick and mortar? They're going to want it and we can't upset them. We can't say no. The answer was, well, why not? You can say no, right? So that's what they did. They took a new flavor. They put it on Amazon and it was exclusive to Amazon. And then what they did is it was very similar to kind of a crowdfunding event, because by growing that listing on Amazon, they started building sales, they built reviews. All that created more of a buzz. You know, you can see the reviews, you can see the sales ranking on Amazon, and your brick and mortar partners can see that. And the more they did it, the more those brick and mortar partners wanted the product even more. And, you know, 3 months in, with a huge success on this product, those partners came in and said, well, what can we have? It said, well, we still have another couple of months of commitment to Amazon, but as soon as that period is over, we're going to release it to you for sure. And that's what they did. At the end, it worked both for Amazon, for the brand, and for the retailers, because those retail partners know now that this product has already been validated online. It's a flavor that everybody loves based on the reviews, based on the sales. So if they put it in their stores, it's a lower risk product, right? Now that's what they do. They launch a product exclusively on their website and on Amazon. And then once they see success, they move that new flavor into their traditional brick and mortar channels.
They're vetting the product, basically.
Exactly.
And I guess that creates pent-up demand from the retailer. And then hopefully that drives sales to the rest of their offerings, right?
It does. I mean, it's all about reviews. It's the best way to quantify customer feedback.
Yeah, so that theme keeps coming up, and that's kind of using the internet to measure interest, which I guess is the biggest risk that you guys face. We always talk about Shark Tank. The first question is, you know, what's your revenues? If a company doesn't have revenue, and I know that's obviously usually a death knell, but there's been times where sharks have, with little or no revenue, just on the idea of taking a risk. Do you have an example where that kind of happened, where there wasn't really a solid revenue base, but then it became a success just because the idea was, or the founder had a specific skill set you guys were impressed with?
Yes. There's always examples of entrepreneurs that get on the show that have that sense of just tenacity, and they have a certain delivery on the show, right? They know their product. They know their customer. They just have a better overall understanding of where they want to take this company or product. And it doesn't matter what age you are as an entrepreneur. We have an entrepreneur who was 16, 17 when she got on the show, Lainey Lazari from Simple Sugars. I mean, she started her company in her kitchen doing sugar scrubs. And when she got on the show, she had $70,000 in sales. But that was very impressive for Mark, that a young girl that age was able to generate $70,000 in sales just from making products in her kitchen, selling them online on her website, and going door to door and selling product. For him, the upside was the entrepreneur and not the product. And he was right. I mean, that company did almost $400,000 to $500,000 in sales within 24 hours of airing the show. She did about $2.1 million that same year. Mark invested $100,000. She gave him back a $200,000 check within 6 months, and they did a follow-up on that. Another example is an even younger contestant, Q-Flex. I mean, she was 12 when she got on the show, and it's an even more simple product. It's like a trigger point device, similar to like a Theracane for the back. It looks like a question mark. Mark was impressed with how she went door to door selling that product. She did $10,000 in sales, and then she got on the show. Just a simple website, one product. She also did about $400,000 in sales within 24 hours. So you have those success stories where, you know, obviously it's a great product, but it's also the entrepreneur that drives success at the end of the day.
Yeah, we always say that Mark really respects the hustle, and that's right. We're watching the show. We always like that. It's the intangible. At the end of the day, what are the attributes or the things that Mark Cuban companies or the companies that you guys invest in, what do you hope is your differentiator from, say, going with another VC or another investor?
So why should companies pick Mark? It's a combination of Mark's strategic advice and a lot of the tactical support that Mark's team provides. We have a very smart team that's very well connected, and we can help tactically get those companies prepared and provide opportunities for growth. And Mark steers very well strategically to guide them for those growth opportunities. And what's been interesting is over the evolution of the show, it's very satisfying to see how those companies have grown from nothing and have achieved very aggressive sales goals. And some of them have been sold to other companies. Some have gotten a lot of additional investment through other investors and have pursued additional growth goals. So it's really nice to see how those companies have continuously evolved beyond the show. So it wasn't just one event that created this sales opportunity online, but it's the continuation of growth through the support of the shark, through the effort and tenacity of the entrepreneur. There's a competitive spirit I've noticed between the Shark Tank alums. They all want to compete with each other and outperform each other, which motivates them even more.
So you've been with Mark now a good amount of time. What investment surprised you early on, given his tech background?
So early on, I think every new industry that he would invest in would be a surprise. But now that he's invested in almost every type of industry, especially on the consumer product side, nothing is a surprise. So he's invested in food, he's invested in cosmetics, apparel, outdoor products, technology, you name it. There's over 70 Shark Tank companies in his portfolio, and it's growing every season.
So we know that there's a pretty short turnaround from when a company's going to be airing. And I'm assuming you're going to need some pretty fairly robust e-commerce tools that go along with that process. What are some of those tools that you've seen over the years and then what you're using today that you feel like are providing a lot of value for your companies?
So we recommend that our companies go on a Shopify e-commerce platform because Shopify, in our experience, hasn't crashed on an airing Shark Tank. So that's a very important feature. But also, it's easy to use. Anyone who's non-technical can learn Shopify within a very short period of time and set up a really nice looking website. It also has a lot of apps that you can add on to add more bells and whistles to your website. So we like it for that reason. But the most important reason, it's robust and it doesn't crash. And it's a full turnkey e-commerce solution. So it has the e-commerce engine and then it also is a self-hosted solution.
And it's agnostic to other platforms.
Right. And then the other thing we recommend is for smaller companies that are fulfilling their own products, we recommend they use ShipStation, which is an extension of Shopify. It works as an extension or separate tools. But ShipStation allows you to streamline the fulfillment process internally. So if you can just get a thermal printer and then print all your labels, and behind the scenes, it communicates the tracking info back to Shopify. And then as you grow out of your space, that's where it's good to move to a Celery. And they'll just take on your ShipStation account as is and continue growing it. So nothing changes. You just don't have to worry about packing and shipping boxes and focusing on selling your products.
Shark Tank's been a huge success here domestically, and now we're starting to see it re-air on CNBC. What's been the impact of re-syndication, and what's that meant outside the United States?
Yeah, CNBC syndication that has global exposure for the show has been great. It's allowing our small companies to have access to all these international markets. So I'll give you an example. I get a call from one of the entrepreneurs saying, hey, we've got flooded with emails from Spain and everybody wants to sell our product in Spain. What happened? Well, it's because their show just happened to air in Spain that night. So they need to figure out how to also to take advantage of those opportunities and start thinking globally. Obviously, the priority for early stage in the U.S. is to maximize their exposure in the U.S., but they also have to think globally because it's a huge market with a lot of potential, but it has challenges. Each market has its own challenges and requirements to sell, also depending on the category. Selling a widget is easier than selling a food or a cosmetic product because of the regulatory aspect. But it's definitely something that our companies are getting exposed to, and it's a process to learn, and it also adds a different perspective, right? It allows the entrepreneur to think in kind of a multidimensional way that it's not just about selling your product across the street. There's a huge world out there. And in order to maximize your potential as a brand, you have to think globally and think about all the different markets that are overseas that you can tap into. And there's a lot of partnerships that you can establish from that as well.
Abe, what are you excited about right now? What's on the horizon in 2018 for the Mark Cuban companies?
Well, currently season 9 in Shark Tank. Just heard a couple of days ago that the show got renewed for one more season, season 10. So we're helping season 9 companies, but you know, come June of this year, we're going to start working on the due diligence for a whole new set of companies. So it's just a nonstop process of, you know, supporting onboarding new companies, growing them, and then continuously supporting the existing portfolio, finding new opportunities for growth. And we're always looking for a new way of selling our products, a new way of partnering, just a new way of using technology just to accelerate growth.
Well, that's all for episode 14 of Celery Talks. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you back here for episode 15, where Tad talks to David Calkins about capturing sound and transforming audio to personalize canvas art. Subscribe and leave a review on iTunes, and you can listen on Google Play as well as Podomatic.com.